Today is Wednesday, November 22nd. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, President Trump finally speaks out about a Senate candidate accused of sexual misconduct.
I can tell you one thing for sure. We don't need a liberal person in there, a Democrat.
As Zimbabweans celebrate the resignation of Robert Mugabe, critics say his replacement isn't much different. The latest on the search efforts for a missing Argentinian submarine with 44 people on board, and what Queen Elizabeth gave her husband on their 70th wedding anniversary. It's all on today's International Edition. The streets of Zimbabwe's capital, Harare, erupted in celebration Tuesday after President Robert Mugabe resigned, ending 37 years in power. Mugabe has been one of Africa's most controversial and influential figures, who outmaneuvered his opponents for decades but was undone by his own miscalculation in his final weeks in power when he sidelined his right-hand man in order to position his wife, Grace, as his successor. He didn't anticipate that the firing of his vice president, Emmerson Mnangagwa, would swiftly depose him. Well, the 75-year-old Mnangagwa, who is expected to be sworn in as president this week, was a young Chinese-trained guerrilla fighter during Zimbabwe's bloody 1970s War of Independence, who had been a close associate of President Mugabe for nearly four decades, and critics say he hardly represents a change. From Johannesburg, VOA's Anita Powell reports on the man called the Crocodile, with reporting from Sebastian Mufu of in Harare.
For 37 years, Emmerson Mnangagwa was Robert Mugabe's right-hand man and one of his staunchest defenders. Mnangagwa was at a ZANU-PF rally in central Zimbabwe earlier this year. ZANU-PF is a sacred party, he tells the crowd. It will rule and rule. Those barking will continue doing that while ZANU-PF remains in power. Forward with Mr. Mugabe. Forward with ZANU-PF, he says. What a difference a few months make. Now deposed Vice President Mnangagwa, nicknamed the Crocodile for his cunning guerrilla tactics in Zimbabwe's independence war, is leading calls for Mugabe to step down. Last week, the military put Mugabe under house arrest, demanding Mnangagwa's reinstatement and Mugabe's resignation. Mugabe fired Mnangagwa earlier this month, accusing him of treachery. The move was widely seen as a chance for Mugabe to fill the position with his unpopular 52-year-old wife, Grace Mugabe. Since 1980, Mnangagwa has served in a handful of cabinet positions, including as intelligence chief, and he was made vice president in 2014 after Mugabe fell out with his predecessor, Joyce Majuru, now also a bitter Mugabe critic. Mnangagwa's investiture, in fact, would settle a bitter generational power struggle within the ruling party. One faction of Liberation-era fighters-turned-politicians is led by Mnangagwa, who earned his nickname in 1965, the year Grace Mugabe was born. The other, the G40 faction of younger Zimbabweans, was led by Grace Mugabe and enjoyed privileged access to her husband. Chris Muchanga, head of the influential War Veterans Association, said they are supporting Mnangagwa. He blamed the nation's struggling economy on the poor leadership of the younger faction.
They have no idea of how to run a modern state, so they've run a scorched-earth policy on the economy. But what we have done with my leadership of the war veterans is to give back the people of Zimbabwe their conscience, because they look to the people who fought and liberated them for guidance. And when we then said there's something wrong with this man and his wife and the team, the cabal called the G40.
Is Mnangagwa a breath of fresh air? Zimbabwean scholars are quick to note he is widely credited with being the architect of Gakura Hundi, a series of army-led massacres of political and ethnic rivals in the 1980s. Mnangagwa has maintained a low profile since his firing, but in a widely circulated statement Tuesday, he criticizes the regime's corruption, incompetency, dereliction of duty and laziness, social and cultural decadency. But why now? Perhaps Mnangagwa let his intentions show in an interview 2 years ago with local media, in which he spoke proudly of his nickname, the Crocodile. It never goes in the villages or in the bush looking for food, he said. It strikes at the appropriate time. Could this be Emmerson Mnangagwa's time? Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Well, the weather in the South Atlantic, plagued by high waves and winds, did improve somewhat on Tuesday as the international search and rescue effort for a missing Argentine submarine continued. There are growing concerns that the German-built sub with a crew of 44 is running low on oxygen nearly a week after disappearing, after reporting an electrical malfunction nearly 500 kilometers off the Argentine coast. Among those on board was Argentina's first female submarine officer. More than a dozen vessels from Argentina, Brazil, Chile, the U.S., and Britain are involved in the search. And authorities investigated reports of white flares and a raft, but neither is believed to have come from the ARA San Juan. VOA's Victor Beatty got an update on the search with Commander Eric Reynolds with the U.S. Navy's 4th Fleet based in Mapleport, Florida.
For the U.S. support, we have two P-8 Poseidon Maritime Patrol aircraft that are out there. And then we are providing elements of the Undersea Rescue Command, which provides equipment for the rescue of and the crew on the submarine. And it has several parts. They have the submarine rescue chamber, and then they also have a pressurized rescue module. Two pieces of equipment basically do the same thing, but they just have different varying depths that they can work in. So we've flown that equipment down from San Diego, flown it to Argentina, and we're loading. We've already loaded one contracted vessel and taken it out to the search area, and then we're continuing to load the second vessel as we speak here. And our primary purpose here is supporting a request from the government of Argentina for international assistance in this ongoing search for the missing submarine and with any rescue opportunities that may be identified once the vessel and crew are located.
This submarine, a German-built diesel-electric submarine, as I understand it, went down on Wednesday. How is the search being conducted? What clues are you looking for, and what hope do you have of finding it?
We always have hope. It's time-sensitive. The Argentinians are leading the search, and we are supporting.
Are they going to take soundings using sonar? How are they conducting the search?
For the aerial search, you have that wide visibility, especially when the weather's clearing up like it is now. So flares, you can see them at a greater distance, things that might be floating in the water. But the Poseidons are designed to prosecute submarines, to find them. And so they also use sonar, using sonar buoys. And then on the surface side, with the international ships that are out there, UK, of course, Argentina, they are fighting both the visual but also using sonar to both active and passive to search out in the search box.
The sub carried enough food, according to officials, enough oxygen and fuel for the crew to survive up to about 90 days on the sea's surface, but only enough oxygen to last about a week if submerged. Obviously, concerns have to be growing about the survivability.
There is. As I said, a time is crucial. There's a lot of variables that can go into how long the crew can survive. A lot of variables.
All right. That's Commander Eric Reynolds with the U.S. Navy's 4th Fleet. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. A suicide bomber kills at least 50 in Nigeria. The U.S. launches new airstrikes against the Islamic State in Libya. The White House asks the Supreme Court to uphold its travel ban. And the U.S. is ending temporary permits for almost 60,000 Haitians. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. President Donald Trump all but endorsed embattled Alabama Republican Senate nominee Roy Moore Tuesday, discounting the sexual assault allegations against him and repeatedly insisting voters must not support Moore's, quote, liberal Democratic rival.
Well, he denies it. Look, he denies it. I mean, if you look at what is really going on, and you look at all the things that have happened over the last 48 hours, he totally denies it. He says it didn't happen. And, you know, you have to listen to him also. You're talking about, he said 40 years ago this did not happen.
Well, after more than a week of silence on the subject, the president said he would announce next week whether or not he'll campaign for Moore, who faces Democrat Doug Jones in a December 12th special election to fill the seat once held by Attorney General Jeff Sessions. Trump was also asked what he thinks about all the women coming forward with allegations about powerful men in government and media.
Very special. I think it's a very special time because a lot of things are coming out, and I think that's good for our society. And I think it's very, very good for women. And I'm very happy a lot of these things are coming out. And I'm very happy it's being exposed.
Two Alabama women have accused Moore of assault or molestation, including one who says she was 14 at the time. And six others have said he pursued romantic relationships when they were teenagers and he was a deputy district attorney in his 30s. Meanwhile, CBS News and PBS have cut ties with anchor Charlie Rose after several women accused him of sexual misconduct. President Trump and Russian President Vladimir Putin agreed Tuesday to support the United Nations effort to peacefully resolve the nearly seven-year-long Syrian civil war. Trump talked on the phone with Putin a day after the Russian leader held discussions in Russia with Syrian leader Bashar al-Assad about a political resolution to the civil war that has killed 400,000 people. State Department spokeswoman Heather Nauert Tuesday said, was asked about the president's relationship with Putin, given that Putin was seen in a photo hugging Bashar al-Assad.
You know, things are obviously complicated with Russia. I mean, we've all seen that picture where he's hugging Bashar al-Assad, where President Putin is that. You know how we feel about the chemical attacks that were launched on innocent civilians in Syria. I think we all feel the same way about that as human beings and certainly as Americans as well. I think that hug is proof that Vladimir Putin bears a certain responsibility for trying to help out Syria, for trying to get Bashar al-Assad to, trying to get that government to put pressure on Bashar al-Assad so they don't do something like that again.
Well, the White House said the two leaders talked for more than an hour and stressed the importance of ending the humanitarian crisis in which millions of Syrians have been displaced from their homes. Nauert also was asked about what the U.S. is doing to address the growing humanitarian crisis in Yemen, where malnourished children are dying every day.
A horrific situation that is going on in Yemen. It is something that our team has watched very closely. The ambassador to Yemen and I were exchanging emails just yesterday about the situation on the ground there. He's not in Yemen right now because we don't have that operation there, but he recently visited to take a look himself. I can tell you we're working very closely with the government of Saudi Arabia. As you well know, we have a good relationship with the government of Saudi Arabia to try to encourage better humanitarian assistance. We recognize the food and the aid and the supplies that are needed in Yemen.
Nauert said Saudi Arabia has assured the State Department that ports under the control of the government of Yemen are open for bringing in humanitarian assistance, but she admitted that it's not happening quickly enough given how dire the situation is. Well, the Trump administration is considering whether or not to allow imports of some African elephant hunting trophies into the United States. Initial reports that the administration might lift an existing ban on these imports sparked widespread outrage, with the president tweeting on Friday that a decision would be put on hold until officials could assess the most recent conservation data. It's reigniting the debate about big game trophy hunting, with many conservation groups condemning the practice as inhumane, while others see it as economically beneficial with broader implications for conservation. VOA's Elizabeth Chernoff has more.
For now, American sport hunters overseas cannot bring their African elephant trophies back into the United States. The topic made news last week after the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service posted this statement, appearing to lift the current ban on elephant trophy imports from Zimbabwe and Zambia. After widespread backlash, the president and his interior secretary took to Twitter, saying they needed more time to review conservation facts before making a policy decision. The practice of trophy hunting sparked global controversy in 2015 after an American doctor killed the renowned Cecil the Lion, raising tough questions for hunting advocates and conservationists alike.
There is an argument for many people that hunting can bring revenues to poor people and communities living in Africa. And at the same time, it's assumed then that the enforcement mechanisms are in place to ensure that this is done properly. What we've seen, for example, with the shooting of Cecil, is that the systems don't actually work very well.
Ethical issues of big game hunting are the focus of a recent documentary titled Trophy. It examines how the hunting industry is financing the breeding of endangered species by exploiting a small percentage for the thrill of the kill while conserving the rest, according to filmmaker Shaul Schwartz.
That's kind of the idea of utilizing animals in this if it pays, it stays way. Now, is that the answer? I don't know. I'm here to raise questions, but I think what we should do in this subject is be less quick to judge and scream.
Chris Moore, an anti-poaching activist from Zimbabwe, says big game hunting can offer local African communities meat and money.
Half of that trophy fee goes back in to building a clinic or school or whatever the community decides. They have committees and a trust which organizes where that goes.
But animal rights groups are not convinced that the costs outweigh the benefits.
Ironically, the most revenue that these areas would earn is if the animals were alive. They earn drastically more money from tourism, particularly ecotourism, from people who want to see these animals alive and in the wild.
Trump administration officials say a decision on elephant trophy hunting policy will be issued in the coming weeks. Elizabeth Chernoff, VOA News, Washington.
You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hi, this is Victor Beatty, managing editor of VOA News. Tune in to the Voice of America's newscasts every hour on the top of each hour, 24/7. Listen to our news and correspondent reports from around the world. VOA is your trusted source for news and information.
Hello, sports fans. This is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports.
I love Sunny Side of Sports.
Please join us for a whole half hour of sports talk and news Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC GMT. On the internet, you can like me on Facebook, follow me on Twitter, and read my blog. Visit voaafrica.com and enjoy the show.
VOA's International Edition continues now with a look at what's trending on social media. Andrew Palchevsky has the latest.
You know, Lori, there's a popular saying that goes, if you assume something, well, we actually can't finish it on air because it uses a word we can't use in our broadcast, but let's just say, if you assume something, it makes a fool out of you and me. And especially with social media, we see this happen. We've talked about fake news and people assuming that things are true when actually they're not. So today we have two stories where you might assume something is true on Facebook, Twitter, or other social networks, but in fact, it is not. And we start with Facebook. Now, Facebook has over 2 billion monthly active users. It is by far the largest social network in the world, and so you would assume that it's also the wealthiest. And it was up until Tuesday, because after the markets closed in Hong Kong, Chinese company Tencent actually is now worth more than Facebook, making it the most valuable social network in the world. Facebook ended the day at $519 billion. Tencent closed the market $522 billion. Tencent might not be a name that a lot of our listeners are familiar with, but surely they're familiar with one of their biggest products, WeChat, a chat app that has grown around the world and has rivaled other social networks in terms of popularity. Now, because these two companies are so close together, it's possible that Facebook could retake the top slot as the highest earning social network. But right now, the crown belongs to Tencent.
All right. Well, thanks, Andrew. You can follow him on Twitter at APAL. We also invite you to follow the International Edition stream at VOA_IE. Well, for now, we're joined by Rare.us content editor Nicole Moschella for the latest in entertainment news from the lighter side of news. Nicole, it's a big deal when anybody celebrates decades of marriage, and especially if you're in the royal family. Tell us how the Queen and Prince Philip celebrated.
They did celebrate their platinum wedding anniversary, 70 years together on Monday. And what do you get a man that well, has it all because he's Prince Philip, but also that you've been married to for 70 years.
Right.
So Queen Elizabeth celebrated that occasion by making him a knight. She made him, she gave him the title of Knight of the Grand Cross of the Royal Victorian Order, as if his name wasn't long enough. And this, this is the highest honor that can be given to somebody who serves in the royal family. And after the big knighting, they celebrated with their family, including Prince William and Prince Harry, Duchess Catherine, Camilla, and Charles, with a big, big party at Buckingham Palace. So congratulations. I'd love to know their marriage secrets.
No kidding. You're about to get married yourself. Yes. So you, it's always good to get advice from people who've made it that long.
Definitely. Maybe I'll knight my future husband someday, too.
Maybe. That would be cool. Okay, and then you've got some news about Harrison Ford. He's often been seen on camera in films as an action hero, and it sounds like he put that to use in real life.
Yes, all those years of Indiana Jones worked out for him this past weekend. He was a real-life hero when he saw a woman driving in California who swerved off the road into a ditch. He stopped his own vehicle, jumped out of the car, and was able to pull her to safety. She was taken to the hospital with minor injuries, but I believe she's now since been released. And this isn't the first time that he has just sprung into action as a civilian and not a movie star. He, in 2015, jumped out of his BMW or Mercedes and directed traffic when people were blocked in a tunnel. And he's actually survived at least one plane crash and one near plane crash just last year. And the one he survived was in 2015. So he's definitely got angels on his side, or at least all those years of playing a action star has helped make him a little more agile.
No kidding. And think about the woman to be rescued by none other than Harrison Ford. That's a story in itself, too.
Exactly.
All right, Rare.us content editor Nicole Moschella. A new film starring Oscar nominee Benedict Cumberbatch, The Current War, looks at the conflict between inventor Thomas Edison, industrialist George Westinghouse, and Nikola Tesla at the dawn of the electric age. As VOA's David Byrd tells us, the film was originally slated to be released this week, but has been pushed back to next year because of the ongoing sexual harassment scandal surrounding its producer, Harvey Weinstein.
Benedict Cumberbatch plays Thomas Edison in The Current War. Edison, the inventor of the light bulb, prefers direct current, while his nemesis in this film, Pittsburgh-based industrialist George Westinghouse, played by Michael Shannon, favors the more efficient, if more dangerous, alternating current. Originally, Westinghouse wanted to cooperate with Edison, but when the inventor skips a crucial meeting because he has the financial backing of J.P. Morgan, any hope of cooperation fades. Benedict Cumberbatch says that he was drawn to the role of the prickly inventor because of the challenge of playing Thomas Edison.
It was the moment when we turned Promethean and created Day Out of Night. That's kind of an exciting chapter of history, no matter who you're playing in. And I just thought, you know, it's a challenge to play such a totemic figure in American culture. And I like a challenge.
Michael Shannon says he tried to play Westinghouse as a multidimensional character and not let him slip into an egotistical caricature.
It's inevitable, I think. I mean, if you have some success, or every once in a while you're going to think you're a big deal, but you know, these guys were constantly getting knocked down a peg, too. For every success they had a failure, you know, and it wasn't always easy.
Nicholas Holt plays Nikola Tesla, a former assistant to Edison, who goes to work for Westinghouse.
He really believed in supplying power and the future and that being right for everyone to have. So it was, for him, it was something very different. Although the one thing about him that was interesting, even when he was penniless and falling on hard times, he would always make sure that he was very well presented and looking spick and span.
The film has received moderate reviews, with director Alfonso Gomez-Rejon criticized for too much use of Dutch angles and special effects. However, the director says that he wanted audiences to get a sense of the change the film represents.
My thing was to interpret the period, interpret that. I didn't have
10 hours to tell the story, so you distill it to something that moves you and that hopefully captures the feeling of the time.
The Current War, released by the Weinstein Company, was scheduled to hit theaters November 24th. However, it has been pushed back to a 2018 date, still to be determined, because of the ongoing sexual harassment scandal surrounding producer Harvey Weinstein. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
Before I go insane, I hold my pillow to my head and spring up in my bed, screaming out the words I dread. I think I love you.
Actor and singer David Cassidy has died. Publicist Joanne Geffen released a statement Tuesday evening saying Cassidy had died surrounded by those he loved. Geffen said on Saturday that Cassidy was in a Fort Lauderdale, Florida hospital suffering from organ failure. He played an aspiring musician in the 1970 sitcom The Partridge Family and quickly became a teen idol, selling millions of records as the musical group's lead singer. The single, I Think I Love You, featuring Cassidy on lead vocals, hit number one on the Billboard charts in 1970 and sold more than 5 million copies. David Cassidy was 67 years old. You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thank you for being with us. Thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Dave Magnus. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a good day.
An editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.
On the fourth Thursday in November, Americans celebrate Thanksgiving. The celebration is rooted in the ancient tradition of the Harvest Festival, but in the United States it has taken a far greater significance. Although there are numerous regional claims as to where the first Thanksgiving was celebrated, the traditional observance stems from a celebration that took place in Massachusetts in November 1621. Those English settlers who celebrated that first Thanksgiving truly did have much for which to be thankful. Known today as the Pilgrims, these Christian church, as part of their religious beliefs, they observed days of fasting and days of thanksgiving in response to events they believed to be special acts of providence. The end of a drought or of a plague might call for a day of thanksgiving. Intent on setting up a community wherein they could live according to their own religious beliefs, they sailed out of England on a ship called the Mayflower in September 1620. 102 would-be colonists and some 30 crew came ashore at Cape Cod on November 9th. Within a year, half of them were dead due to starvation, disease, and the harsh weather conditions of that first winter. But the summer brought a good harvest, and in autumn, 53 pilgrims sat down to a feast with 90 of their neighbors, Wampanoag Indians, who had helped feed and safeguard them over their first year in the New World. Although the holiday had been observed in Virginia since the first permanent colony was founded in Jamestown in 1609, modern Thanksgiving was first officially established in all states in 1863 by a presidential proclamation of Abraham Lincoln. The observance was moved to the fourth week in November by President Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Thanksgiving began as a prayer of gratitude by immigrants who faced death, who nevertheless came through and endured. Today, for many Americans, it is an occasion for gatherings of family and friends, a day to share a holiday meal with those who matter the most, and a day to give thanks for the many blessings of freedom.
That was an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.